Welcome back to Silk Flowers and
Papier-Mâché Hearts. We are your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. And this week we are finishing up our conversation with Emer Murphy. Thanks for joining us again.
Hello.
So we had some great stories last week. and I think we want to jump right into just the nuts and bolts of working in Ireland and how Irish theater works.
How does Irish theater work?
So I know you, you've been following your American cohorts for a while on the spam message board. So you kind of get a sense of just how our theaters are laid out. And so I'm wondering if it's basically the same stage managers, prop masters.
The sort of the first inkling that I had that there was a huge difference in how we do things is there was a Broadway show called I Am My Own Wife that the Dublin Theatre Festival bought over, invited over. And it was before I was working in the Abbey. I was still freelance at the time. And they asked me to prop it. So basically recreate everything that was on that stage. And so if you know that set, it was this enormous, basically warehouse shelving. It's the entire width and height of the set. So the entire back wall of the set is warehouse shelving full of antiques, jammed full of antiques.
Yeah.
And there were very specific antiques of a very specific time period that were being collected. There were being the story of the pieces that the protagonist is saving, German artworks from the Nazis during the war. Mm-hmm. And because they're pillaging and taking whatever, and she's saving them and housing them, keeping them safe. And so it's everything that she's managed to save, and it's a lot of stuff. So there was a lady called Worth Strecker, and she and her partner was called Nancy. They were the prop master and the stage manager of the show from Broadway, and so we were communicating with on telephone and email. And I was trying to recreate as best I could here what they had on Broadway. And it was an interesting, because what she had got over there was kind of what she could get, the closest things that she could find at the time to being these very specific German antiques and artworks. And so what I found myself trying to find were American versions of German antiques, you know what I mean? But anyway, in any case, they came and they flew over. The first time I met them, I brought them out to the warehouse where I had gathered everything. And I had gathered everything by raiding from Stephen Malloy at the time, because I was still freelance. I used to come into Stephen all the time. And raiding from Stephen and raiding from everywhere I could raid from and hiring some things. In any case, they came out and I had a look. And they were really very generous in their praise for me and my ability. And then we went for a pint. Afterwards, they said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go for it. But they were literally off the plane. They were still jet lagged. We went for pints. And they said, I'll never forget, Worth said, she said, how long have you been a prop master or something? And I said, oh, no, I'm a stage manager. They went, what? And I said, yeah, I'm an assistant stage manager. And they couldn't get their head around it. And I remember Worth saying, I said, do you not? And she was like, no, honey. I do the things. She points at Nancy. She does the people. I do the things. I do not do people. She does not do things. And I went, wow, because we don't have that here. The assistant stage managers prop the shows. Mm-hmm. That's the way it works. There are no professional prop people in this country. There are the professional prop people, in theater. There are professional prop people in film, but it doesn't cross over to theater. Companies hire assistant stage managers who, you know, they're on the lowest wage of the stage management teams, and they are the least experienced, and they're expected to prop, like, you know, shows. Oh, like, as see, Americans find this astonishing, I tell our stage managers all the time, our ASMs all the time, you know that side, to reflect it back to them and say, you know, people in America think this is madness that you're expected to do this. And on the, you know, on the smallest wage and under the assistant title. So it sort of minimizes the contribution of
extremely.
The props you know, as an element. And it's So we struggle here with I feel like an evangelist or something. We struggle with the recognition for what we do. ASMs some of them are good at it. Like I was good at it. I just happened to be an ASM who was good at it. And so they used to get me to prop things. But I was still an ASM into my 30s. I remember myself and Sarah Bacon, who has now gone on, she retrained and became a designer. The two of us sitting in her van with our heads in our hands going, we are the oldest ASMs in the country. because we didn't want, we weren't interested in calling shows. We were interested in props. And that was where our talents lay. But that meant that in our mid-30s, we were taking orders from people in their 20s who were calling the show because that we were just in the stage management system. And, doing two people's jobs at once, because you still, after propping all the shows, you still had to turn around and run the show. So you're on the show running it every night.
Oh, goodness.
Doing all of the things an ASM does and setting out the props and ironing costumes or whatever. If you were on the road, if you were on tour, ASMs in Ireland do everything and they get paid the least amount of anyone and they really should be a revolution. Damn it. I keep saying that. I'll be the first out storming the barricades because it's crazy. Like it is crazy. And they will, so people will stay ASMs for a while and usually they will know, they have an organizational top mind, so they think, I'll go towards the production management side. ASM is a sort of gateway drug to everything else. So it's someone, or someone who has a design, then they'll go on. But if you were an ASM who was interested in props and you wanted to stay in props, you either left theatre altogether and went into film or you sucked it up and stayed doing what you were doing. And it came to a point where I just thought, I can't do this anymore. And I didn't know what I was going to do, frankly. And I thought I was just going to, I wasn't going to be two things at once anymore. I was going to say, okay, if you're hiring me, because I got tons of work because I do two people's jobs. So if you're hiring me as ASM on this gig, then I'm ASMing and then you will hire a prop maker. Because I used to make, because I made props as well. I just happened to be handy and I made things. And so you'll never be out of work if you can do all of that, obviously. But so I would say, I was stealing myself up to say, I'm not going to take. So if you, I'm just to be clear, I will stage manage if that's what you want, or I will make props if that's what you want, but I'm not doing both. Because it's just suddenly dawned on me that I was doing either an ASM or a stage manager or a prop maker out of a job, and I needed to, and also I just didn't want to be doing this stage management thing anymore anyway. So what ended up happening was I got a phone call from Riverdance.
I love that show so much.
They needed somebody to go out to North America at short notice to cover for somebody who wanted to come home, and they knew that I had American passport. I'm an American. I was born in New York. So they didn't have to get a visa for anybody. So they were always trying to get me to go out there. And it never suited me because I was always busy, and I was in a relationship and lots of things. I didn't fancy it. But I went out for that stopgap, which was supposed to be for 9 weeks, and I ended up doing 3 years with Riverdance all around North America. And that was my break. That was my opportunity to come back when I got back and say, okay, I just decided I was going to say I'm no longer a stage manager. If you want me to prop shows, I'll prop shows, and see how long I would be able to, see if I'd be able to eat and pay rent if I did that. And I was just very lucky. I got a couple of different gigs, and I think I got a tour and something. And then the job in the Abbey came up, and I went for it and got it. So I was lucky. I was very lucky.
So is that the only prop master job
in Ireland?
In Ireland,
it's the only one that I know of. There are seasonal ones. There's one in Wexford Opera, for the Wexford Opera Festival. They have someone who does it for them, but it's for the duration of the festival. I think that they have people in possibly in the North of Ireland, but there's nobody else that I know that is full time props in Ireland. And it does sound mad, but that's just the way it is, you know, and everybody understands it in Ireland. And so, so like somebody from the spam thing came about because Sean McCardle was over with us. He came over with dearly departed Sam Shepherd to do piece in The Peacock that was Stephen Ray. What was it called? Ages of Moon. And it needed this spinning fan, that this ceiling fan that gets shot and falls. Sam had written in the script, it falls like a Vietnam, like a helicopter has been shot out of the sky in
right,
Vietnam.
Yeah, falls. With a so he's shower of sparks this, and
yeah, and then this plume of smoke as it falls, and then it's supposed to do all these other things. So so he had written that, and immediately people were going, "Oh, I don't know." And he said, "It's okay. I have a guy," and he brought Sean over.
Right,
and we had such a great laugh, and we had a great time, and he was kind of my first connection with someone, you know, who does it at that level. Like, and Sean's so great.
Right.
And, and it was during the rugby. We had such a great time. We were watching rugby all the time, mm-hmm. pub across the road, and we'd a ball. So he said to me, "I have to get you into this group." And I said, yeah. Oh, God, I couldn't do that. Sure, I'm only making it up. Because you're also trained, and you know, you've done all these amazing courses, and I'm a chancer, as they'd say here. You know, Stephen would say the same thing. Sure, mm-hmm. I'm only a chancer. We just learned on the job, and happened to have an aptitude for it. So I didn't follow up at the time, I remember. And then we were doing a piece with Wayne Jordan, a director of Wayne Jordan, and he said, I have a challenge for you. And I said, "Oh yeah, what is it?" And he said, I want a character to be able to blow a, what did he say? It's a real Dublin expression, Jimmy Joe. I want him to be able to blow a Jimmy Joe. And I went, "I don't know what that is. What are you talking about?" And it was a dandelion clock. It was just a Dublin slang. I didn't know what it meant. On stage, I want her to pick wildflowers, and then she blows the head off the dandelion clock. And so I started mm-hmm. trying to figure it out, and I had a little time to figure it out. So I was, you know, as you do, and playing with monofilament and whatever. And then I made the classic error the week before rehearsal started. He came in and I said, "Come here and I'll show you the prototype," which wasn't finished. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to explain to him, and I showed him, and I said, "And then it's going to do this, and I'm going to do that with it." And I remember him to this day, and he claims that he didn't at all. But I remember him making a face and going, "Oh, I don't know, I'm not convinced." and I just went, "Oh no, oh God," because I thought it was going to work. And so I emailed Sean. Mm-hmm. I had emailed Sean a couple of times about, any of those prop people that you talk about, has any of them ever done this? So I emailed Sean and I said, "This is what he wants to do." And Sean said, let me get back to you. And Sean came back with an answer from Jim Guy, mm-hmm. which was that somebody there had done it and described what they had done. And it was exactly what I had done, And it gave me such a indescribable mm-hmm. support. And
it's very mm-hmm. validating.
I mean, like, you know what? You know, maybe I'm not a chancer, as much of a chancer as I think I am, and maybe I'm actually kind of good at this, you know, because there's always this kind of, what's the word, imposter syndrome that you have.
Yes.
So true.
Yeah. But then to be validated by, especially somebody like Jim, you know, was one of the artisans that worked for him, and to say, yeah, we thought about it and we came up with this, he described it as an elegant solution. And it was literally exactly what I had done. Mm-hmm. And it was after that, then I joined. I just went, you know what? I want some more of this. It's like a drug. And it really is. It's so. We go to one another all the time and go, "Oh," like I had a meltdown a while ago. I was having a terrible time with something. And I went on, I said, "I'm having such a time." And then everyone would just come on one after the other and go, "Oh, listen, me too." Or, "You think that's bad," and everyone has a terrible story, a worse story of like impossible demands and time running out and budgets shot to hell and whatever else. Yeah. And everyone's got a story, and it's a group of peers of my peers that I don't have here. Mm-hmm. I just don't. The only other person that I have is Stephen, and Stephen has retired. Like he's a year out of the place now. But I will ring Stephen and go, "Oh God, they want this. How did you do that?" And still, I will still ring Stephen and go, "Where is such and such thing?" And Stephen will say, "It's down in the prop room. And you go into the left and look up on." It's extraordinary. He has everything in his head.
Yeah. It's kind of true over here too, especially if you're outside any of the major cities. There's so many props people. As soon as they find out that there's others out there, they kind of like brighten up. They're like, mm-hmm. "I thought I was weird and that there's no use for any of my talents. And everybody else looks at me strange." And all of a sudden I'm in a room with, you know, 20 other people who are doing the exact same thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And people who are, I think it's a Terry Pratchett thing. He talks about one of his old lady characters, and he said, she spotted another old lady and she knew instantly that this is a person who might be convinced to look at photographs of grandchildren, and they had this connection. And I go, yeah, these are the only people I know that would be easily convinced to look at photographs of puppets or props or mad things that you're making and go, look at this thing, and be equally squealy and delighted about it.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There's nobody else. I just don't, yeah, it is. It's very, spam is tremendous. And we had that mass meeting of spam on the Zoom.
Yeah, that was great.
That was bonkers.
I totally missed it.
Bonkers. How many people were on that?
There were maybe up to 30 at some point. 36, I think they might have said, was the high point. And they're going to do it again, so.
Oh, good.
Ashley, definitely jump on.
I had two Zoom meetings at the exact same time yesterday, and somehow I missed both of them.
Yeah, yesterday Fridays are days for catching up with Zoom meetings. A Zoom that I never, none of us ever did anything with Zoom, and now
it's
all Zoom meetings.
Of it. Yeah.
No, I know.
It's like, I know. That's what we have to use. But I know. I've gone to museums with props people before, and there's always like, maybe there's some interesting table somewhere, and you go in and you see the props person has their head under it trying to look at the joinery, and you're that's what I was doing too.
Yes. My tutor, when I was doing the thesis, we had a couple of, you know, day trips into museums and things, and I'd go, oh, we have one of those. She just keep looking at me going, oh my god. I had a moment where there's a lady here called Claudia Kinmuth. She's the Irish vernacular furniture expert. She has a PhD and has written an incredible book. If you ever want a resource book, although they're hard to find and they're expensive, Irish vernacular furniture. If you're ever doing any of the Irish plays, you know, it's all the dressers and the Sugon chairs and the whatever else. But there was a Sugon chair which had been used in Dancing at Lunasa, in the original production of Dancing at Lunasa. But Stephen doesn't remember whether it was bought for that production or whether it had been in the stores for a long time, but anyway, it had been around since the mid-90s at least, and it was just something about it, because Sugon chairs, they're folk chairs and they were made by the people, just made their own furniture, and they have like accents, you know, the chairs have very sort of unique design features, and they're very simple chairs, but there's a different pattern in the weave of the rushes for the seat, or there's a slight difference to the shape, and some of them have arms and some of them don't, but the people who are experts in them can tell what part of the country that they're from. So there was this one chair, as we were talking in the last one, about designers who want to paint things breaking your heart, and this designer saw this chair and wanted to paint it black, gloss black, and that little, I could feel your heart breaking in that one, and I just went no, and I stood up to her, and she was annoyed with me as well, and I had been on to Claudia for something else. Anyway, I took a photograph of the chair and sent it to her, and the chair, these are chairs that are made with no screws, no nails, they're little wedges and tens, they're like incredible. The way they're put together is amazing, these little pegs that they drill out with hand drills, and I took a picture of the chair and I sent it to her, and she was able to tell me that it was from North Donegal. She said it was made between 1892 and 1905, I think she said, that she was able to pinpoint it exactly, like very narrow type thing down. But that made it an antique, as opposed to, you know, and just because it's a handmade, a traditional Irish vernacular piece of furniture and not a Chippendale. If it was a Chippendale, there'd be no question of painting it black.
Yep.
But because it's a Sugon chair, let's paint it black. So I said, no, you're not painting. And then I just took it away. I just said, no, because she loved it, because it's beautiful. And I just took it away. And then Stephen, bless him, because he was still with us at the time, Stephen reproduced it. He just made it something that was a similar shape, and she painted that black, and everyone was happy.
Great.
I've forgotten what was the question again.
It's all right. So now,
it doesn't matter.
Since the theaters don't have prop masters, but if they need custom props, are there prop builders, prop makers, or do they have the scenery department build custom things? Okay.
You know how in America, you have shops. So you have prop shops that will build furniture. Yeah. We don't do that. The level of expertise that you are, when I see people with their prop projects and they're building furniture, that's quite extraordinary. Stephen is the only person that, you know, that Stephen used to build things. But mostly what is done here is things are bought and modified, or and things can be built. But if they are, they're built by the scenic shop. Mm-hmm. Like the set builders will build something specific. I don't think I'm making that up. I might be making that up. No, I'm not making it up. Mostly people find furniture. Do you build furniture because you can't find something of the age, or because that's the best way to make something strong enough for the stage? Is it a combination of both?
I think it depends. Because I mean, sometimes like the designer wants something very specific.
Yeah. We're much more likely.
And it might be something highly stylized too, or something fantastical.
Yeah, so like, well, in that case, it gets built.
So
then, are there freelance prop makers?
There are. They're mostly individuals, but there's a couple of small companies now that they're in the last, like, say, 10 years. There's a guy called Dave Flynn. He was actually working in the Abbey for a while with me. He was my assistant, and he has his own company. There's a couple of other people with their own small company. I mean, we're talking two people or whatever. Right. But yeah, no, there are, and there are specialist prop builders. But the things like, you know, the small things like do stage managers do any making in America? No.
No.
Well, so at any sort of professional level, no. Mm-hmm. And especially once you get into anything with any kind of union, they're kind of managers are under Actors Equity. And most props shops, if they are union, they're IATSE, and so they're completely different. I would say at the level of really kind of storefront or tiny, tiny schools, that sort of thing, where they don't have any kind of technical theater, then you might have an assistant. It is the assistant stage manager who is gathering the props. But at that level, you wouldn't have the budget to necessarily be building stuff. So they might be doing the small crafts, you know, a paper prop, something like that. But they're not going to be building a piece of furniture.
No, so when I was ASMing, one of my first big gigs was the panto, Christmas panto in the Gaiety, pantomime. And that's where you learn to make, you make everything. Right. There was a lady there, and I wish I could remember her name, but she was brilliant. I remember her teaching me. They just said, oh, she comes in and does and helps out. But she was making, she taught me how to make, you know, large scale, indestructible objects. Like in panto, everything is kind of slapstick and larger than life and whatever.
Yes.
And we were making a giant rolling pin that had to be, you know, someone has to be bumped over the head with. And she showed me how to make it. So she just said, oh, this is what we do and this is how we do that. So it was the discovery of the need to make things that didn't just look like something, because I had my primary degree was in film and I trained in camera. So my whole, the way my mind worked was I thought in close up. So I would be looking at things, and when I started making props in the beginning, people were going, no one's going to see that. What are you wasting your time for? Because I always, you know, I focused on the detail. Because that's the way I was trained, and you're looking through the lens of the camera and you're looking in minute close-ups. That's in case you can hear something like a bear in the background, that's my partner yawning in the other room, sorry. So then you had to sort of retrain for theater I always tell students that it's like an impressionist painting. It's broad brush strokes, because it's seen from out front. You're not looking in tiny minute detail. But at the same time, because I thought that way and because I put that much detail into things, It's actually actors that you notice the first sort of appreciation from.
Yeah.
That you're willing to put the time into getting little details right, that they would come up and thank me or talk to me about things. And there's a a different communication that happens when you're responsible for making the thing, or as a stage manager, and just being the person who hands them the thing that came from somewhere else. So I spent a lot of, without knowing what I was doing, I spent a lot of my first kind of few gigs learning how to make things, but also going backwards and forwards to the actors with them and getting the feedback, and actors telling me to modify, could change this or whatever. So I had this relationship with actors that all the way through my stage management career I always had, that I kind of kept up. And without, the when I was writing the thesis about it, I realized that that's how to develop that relationship. There's a thing that happens here a little bit, I think, with the companies who make props, so the freelance production companies that make props, where they just go to their workshop, they make something off a drawing, and they hand it in to the stage managers and they walk away.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they're not quite, that sounds very brutal, but you know what I mean? They're not. Yeah. I was a stage manager. I was in the room with them. So I was watching what they were doing and how they were using the prop. And I go to them afterwards and I go, I could see you were having difficulty with that. What can we do about that? And I would work with them to fix it. And that's what developed that part of my process, I think. So between pantomime, which is crazy, and then the first production company that I worked with a lot when I started off was a company called Barabbas, who are kind of an Irish clown group. And they were innovative and bonkers and wild, and they did crazy things. Like, I remember doing this piece called Hupness, where they had these three clown characters, these kind of naive, innocent clown, red-nosed clown, in a European clown kind of tradition. They had these clown characters living in a metal scrapyard, and they did things like like one of the characters cut her toenails and then ate them. So find us something that looks like toenail that we can eat. You know, those sorts of challenges and conundrums and things. And that was constant. That was like 10 wild challenges a day with Brabus. And it was exhilarating and exhausting and bonkers. And I learned so much from them. And I loved it and hated it at the same time, because I was also stage managing. So I was going home and making things all night long, and coming in the following day to sit in rehearsals all day. Oh, and I remember staying, sitting up until 5 o'clock in the morning, and then going to bed, and then getting up again at 8 and coming in, because I couldn't see any other way of getting the work done to the level that I wanted to do it, you know, to the quality, the standard that I wanted to produce. If I didn't do that, I just couldn't, you know. And I was also in my 20s and very silly. But, do you know, like, I mean, I wouldn't do it now. Yeah. I couldn't do it now. I just wouldn't do it. But I learned an awful lot doing it that way. And I suppose, do prop people, do you ever get to sit in a rehearsal room and watch actors using props, or does that happen?
Yeah, I usually try to sit in the room. It's closer towards tech. We'll watch like a designer run. But if I have the opportunity to jump into the room earlier, if I know there's a specific prop that is being built for, you know, specific reason, or they're using it in a weird way, it's very interactive, I'll try to get into the room earlier just to see what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a different relationship.
Yeah. A lot of times the actors don't really meet me until tech. If it's a real prop heavy scene, I might watch it, and I might sometimes I'll check in, you know, with specific actors. I usually try to pop in every day before rehearsal, and I could kind of see like the whatever mayhem has gone on the day before, the props kind of strewn around, and it's like, it looks like you're throwing that umbrella.
It looks so like you're throwing
it. I'm
going
to reinforce it.
Why is this across
the room?
I know, in five pieces. Ugh,
a lot of times I'm out shopping or I'm building the same time as rehearsal, so I couldn't do both.
Just
every once in a while.
That's the one thing that I miss a lot, because trying to do all of the things at the same time, which I was when I went into, I get less time with the actors, and that's kind of ironic. Now that I'm doing the props and I'm responsible for the props, I actually now understand less of their process than I did when I was stage managing, because in stage management you're immersed in the process and the minutiae of their movements and the blocking, and I don't get to see any of that. So it's like working blind. It's like compared to the way I used to be able to just I used to be connected to it in a completely different way. Yeah. And now I'm trying to, seeing it for the first time in tech, usually what they're doing, yeah. unless like you say, I get to go into the room because it's something specific or mm-hmm. and we're working through it. And try as I might, and I would love to be able to be in the room more. There's just not time. There's never time.
No, there's not. Yeah.
No.
Well, we're also running out of time on this episode as well.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's going so quickly. Thank you so much, Emer, for sitting down again with us. It's been
yes,
such a
yes, thank you so much.
No problem. I'm sorry for talking so much.
No, we it's love it. We absolutely great. Love it. It's so great. Yeah, no, it's been good.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And thanks, everybody, for listening in. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Silk Mache and email us with any questions or ideas that you would like us to talk about on our podcast. You can email those at propspodcast@gmail.com.
And subscribe to us on iTunes and Google Play and Spotify. And check out our website at silkflowersandpapermachehearts.com, where you can find all of our old episodes.
This has been another episode of Silk Flowers and
Papier-Mâché Hearts with your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. We'll see you next time.